The Tom Woods Show, episode 1560.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Get ready for Contra Cruise 2020. This is the fifth cruise economist Bob Murphy and I have hosted together, and it is always a blast. And this year will be no different. Scott Horton and Dave Smith are joining us as special guests. Can you imagine spending a week having a blast with these guys on board a beautiful ship with a bunch of like-minded folks? It's going to be fantastic. Check it out at ContraCruise.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. You remember I told you that around Christmas time, I would have a few episodes, but not the five episodes a week. Typically, at this time of year, I have no episodes at all, but I've given you a few this time of year, this particular year. And this episode is actually the audio of the tremendous panel we had after the New York City premiere of the Housing Bubble documentary. And I'm going to be talking to Jimmy Morrison in the next episode, who really was the brains and the elbow grease behind that. He and I share writing credits in this documentary. And so we had our New York City premiere of it. You can pick it up, by the way, at thebubblefilms.com, because it's actually two films. The second one will be coming out later about the stock market. This is specifically about the housing bubble, and it gives a lot of history as well. It's not just current events. It gives a lot of history of government intervention and financial markets, and it's very, very valuable and helpful. So we had a wonderful panel of financial luminaries who joined us for this New York City premiere. It was emceed by Liz Claman, who hosts Countdown to the Closing Bell on Fox Business. We also had investor David Tice. We had Gene Epstein, who, of course, is well known to you folks from The Tom Woods Show. Peter Schiff, Jim Grant of Grant's Interest Rate Observer. It was an amazing panel with some really, really terrific insights, plus audience Q&A. So I hope you enjoy that. And remember to check out thebubblefilms.com. Oh, by the way, one more thing before I turn it over to this recording. With things like this, occasionally there are glitches. It just can't be helped. So just a quick note on the audio quality. There are several instances of a weird low-end rumble in the recording. And of course, my audio guy did his best to clean them up. But you may still notice a bit of that or the low-end dropping out very noticeably in the places where my audio guy thought the rumble was so severe that it just had to be reduced to make the person speaking intelligible. But the main bulk of it is fine and intelligible and no problem and well worth listening to. So with that, here we go.
Jimmy, it's a painful time to look back for you, having started the business. Give me a sense of why you decided to put this film together.
As I mentioned, I started this house painting business, but really I was pursuing film. I wasn't pursuing house painting. I'd say my parents made me save half of every paycheck through high school for college, and when I got there, it wasn't what I expected at all. And so I dropped out of school and used all the money I had to buy a camera and start a film company. But I realized nobody was going to invest in my projects because I didn't have any experience or a track record. And so I basically just started shooting stuff on my own and using this house painting business as a way to fund my projects and give me the flexibility I needed. But obviously, I didn't have any idea what was going to happen with all this. But from there, after kind of experiencing it, I decided I wanted to get back into economics a little bit. And so I did a torrent search for just the word economics. And the Mises Institute had put a free audiobook online of Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. And that really, obviously, as you can tell, it substantially influenced me. And it really gave me the idea that we should be asking these people that predicted it why it happened and what's next. Because Henry Hazlitt, the things he was writing about in the 1940s really described a lot of what we ended up having happen. So that's kind of a little bit of the background, but at that point, I had the idea to bring on Tom Woods, and he was gracious enough to co-write it. Gene Epstein had actually told him that his book Meltdown should be adapted into a documentary, and Tom said, when am I going to do that? And so when I came to Tom, Gene had already put that idea in his head, and Tom said yes. So here we are 8 years later.
Well, we're so glad you are, because this is sort of the best encapsulation of what happened, why it happened, but more importantly, who saw it coming and who did not. I think probably many of you are really amazed that we are sitting here with, quite frankly, national treasures. People who actually saw it were laughed at, were criticized. And let me start with Peter Schiff. I don't know if a lot of you guys know this, but Peter and I actually went to high school together. And
she was my best student.
Very professor. But then we kind of went in separate directions. And years later, when did you move to Connecticut from California?
2005.
Okay, 2005, really getting up to the height of the crisis, right, to the height of the bubble, rather. And Peter comes to town and says, oh, you know, I'm here, we should get together. And we sit down at Rue 57, you know, up on Midtown. And for the next hour, he starts telling me the whole thing is going to implode. The whole system is going to implode. Subprime mortgages, and Liz, do you know what Alt-A mortgages are? Now, a lot of people were not talking about Alt-A at the time. And I said, no, what are they? He said, subprime with a better FICO score. And he said, if you have any debt that you're owed, pay it off now because rates are going to reset and it's going to get ugly. I ran home. That was a Saturday lunch. And I ran home and I said to my husband, we have to pay off our home equity line of credit because it's going to reset and it's going to be a mess. And he said, where's this coming from? And I said, Peter Schiff. But you saw people laughing at Peter. I'm more interested to know, Peter, how did you know? What was it that you saw in the earliest moments? And go back to California, because you said you were in a building back in Southern California where there were some mortgage guys lending.
Well, yeah, you know, when I started my broker-dealer, and I rented more office space than I needed, and I was expanding more slowly. This is during the dot-com bubble. And so I subleased some of the space, and I was always subleasing it to mortgage lenders. And they were always there. Companies would start up and they would need some space. And I was able to overhear the mortgage brokers, how they were getting people to take out loans and doctoring up their documents and falsifying them. And they were cold calling them. And, oh, I can get you all this cash out. And you could just see the fraud. And they were all originating it. Nobody cared if any of these loans would ever get repaid. They just needed to originate them so they can turn around and resell them.
Okay, but this is one building in Southern California. How did you triangulate it to spread out to the rest of the nation and have confidence that that was actually happening?
Well, I mean, I understood the problem that that was created by Greenspan. You know, if Greenspan had not dropped interest rates down to 1% the way he did, I think the stock market bubble that popped in 2000, there would have been a lot more downside. I mean, I think the Dow would have gone quite a bit lower than it did. I think the NASDAQ, you know, which went from 5,000 to 1,100, probably would have gone to 500. I mean, it would have been a bigger correction had Greenspan not done that. But once he did that and started creating the money, I could see where it was going. I could see what was happening in the housing market. And I knew that it was distorting the economy in ways that were much greater than the dot-com bubble did, because I knew that we were building an entire economy based on home equity and home equity extractions, and people were spending money they didn't have and buying stuff they couldn't afford. And so this whole thing was a big bubble, and I could see the way it was being financed. And you know, it's only a matter of time until the whole thing implodes. And just, you know, it took until 2007, but it finally happened.
Gene, how did you see the crisis coming? What did you notice?
Well, the housing bubble was palpable. I mean, there was no question that if you looked at price indexes, that when you're looking at prices, house prices and price indexes in California and New England going up by 10, 11, 12, 13, 14%, and when the private sector isn't being encouraged to issue mortgages with 3, 4% down payments, that's what brought them in. So all you had to do was look at that and then recognize was that the government was massively encouraging this. And that's when the private sector came in. I want to mention, ironically, in a way, the most heroic, the gutsiest person who saw this coming was Mike Burry of The Big Short. And that movie, The Big Short, which I think is intellectually a shame about only depicting the crazy crony capitalist, the casino capitalist who got involved, and not at all depicting the government, because the crowning irony is that if you speak to Mike Burry, he put a lot of money in line, and he too knew that it was a government-induced housing bubble. That's not in that movie, and it's not in the book. And yet, Mike Burry, played by Christian Bale very well in that movie, If he were here, he would be the guy who we'd really respect, because he put his money where his mouth is, found a way to short the housing market, and made billions of dollars in the process. But he knew that it was a government-induced bubble.
And let me get to you, Jim. Yeah. What did you see that indicated to you that, and I'm talking years ahead of anybody else?
One thing to take away from this, perhaps, is how long a year can be. First quarter, I think, 2001 house prices were up 8%. The Fed funds rate was on its way down. And it was no secret that house prices, even then, were out of line. By 2003 and 4, we began to see these crazy mortgage, this kind of mortgage science projects, collateralized debt obligations, and the rest of the alpha kind of mortgage securities. So 2001, count these years, 1, 2, 3, 4, saying things, as Peter said them, as others said them. On Wall Street, there's this distinction that's almost invisible between being early and wrong. So this has relevance today to see some crazy, I mean, some 13 trillion or so of debt securities worldwide are priced to yield less than nothing, not after adjustment for inflation, but nothing, almost zero. The lender pays the borrower. Nothing like this in 4,000 years of interest rate history. So those of us who have been decrying this ought to recall that you could, and some of us did, suspect or even see that there would be a comeuppance as early as 2001. The elapsed time between 2001 and 2008 was not, as it seems arithmetically, 7 or 8 years. In the years of a Wall Street career, that was about 50 years. Time moved very slowly. So one perhaps forward-looking lesson is that these things can and do go on and on and on. Absurdity piles upon absurdity, and non sequitur upon non sequitur, and humiliation upon humiliation for those who have the money up and who lose it because they were rich slash wrong. But yeah, whatever you ask, Liz, that's the answer.
There is a man sitting up here who is almost one of a kind. And we used to constantly call him when I was at CNBC when we needed a bear, because there were too few bears at the time. And that's David Tice. David, thank you for helping to fund this movie. I'm very interested to know how it came to your attention and why you felt it important to help out with Tom and Jimmy.
Well, I cannot exactly remember meeting Jimmy, but this Jimmy, I think you were 26, weren't you? Yeah. And so he had this story, and he was a believer in the Austrian school, and he'd already nailed down Tom Woods, and I was a big believer in Tom Woods. And I had been such a student of the Austrian school, and as you kindly pointed out, Liz, I had been talking about the Austrian school and the bubble back in 97, 98, 99, because I'd started my Prudent Bear Fund in 1996. People thought I was crazy but that was when Alan Greenspan made his famous irrational exuberance speech. And so I could only keep from pulling out my hair at that point, understanding what caused stock prices to levitate in 97, 98, 99, when I understood that it was this asset inflation due to excessive credit creation. So frankly, I became a disciple of the Austrian school. I wanted the Austrian school to be understood. And when Jimmy came to me and saying, I want to have it understood, you know, it spoke to me. And Jimmy, again, hats off to you for making this such a great educational film. And I think everybody in the audience, I'd like you guys to become disciples of the Austrian school and inform other people, because whenever I meet an economics student, I want to inform them about how important the Austrian school of economics is.
What we're going to do is we're going to whip through a bunch of questions with everybody up here. And yes, you have to stay till the end simply because A, we're going to open it up to questions if that's okay. So B, garnering your questions and getting those together, but B, we're going to spin it forward. What bubbles do they see up here now? But before we get to that, Tom, I wanted to ask you how you looked at this massive pile of clips and this group of people and what challenges you faced in putting the script together.
Oh, well, thank goodness the fast bulk was done by Jim. I was the elder statesman of the project. I had a big picture view, very easy to paint. But Jimmy slogged through all this material. And yet there were certain certain bits and pieces that we all knew, those of us who followed the crisis closely, we all knew had to be. We had to have Peter being not just criticized, but literally laughed at. Because at that moment, Peter, you couldn't realize how awesome that moment is for the future. Because these SOBs laughed at you, and you were so right. And then almost nobody apologized to you later. I mean, it tells you something of these people.
Ben Stein did.
Ben Stein did. That's right. He did. And I give credit for that. But these people, it's like they didn't even pause for a breath. They had been completely refuted in every way possible, and they just kept on talking, Whereas you would think that a few of them would retire to a monastery for 5 years to be silent and do penance or something. That never happens. So we knew that there were certain things that had to go in there. Or you have to love the sequence of quotations from Ben Bernanke, in which he resolutely denies he's printing money, which is just a nitpicking distinction anyway. The effect is as if he's printing money, as he later concedes himself. So so in other words, there were some greatest hits that those of us who followed this so closely knew had to make it in there. And then the question becomes, who are the people who need to be interviewed? Then, you can offer the entire interviews as a bonus, but who are the key people who have to be featured in that thing? And once you talk to those people, the gems and the gold nuggets just come automatically.
When you specifically look at interest rates, right now we're currently for Fed funds rates at 2.25% to 2.5%. That's pretty darn low. And I want to know right now, how is it that people can look at one thing? Remember this thing recently on that broke the internet where do you see the dress is red or is the dress blue or black and red or something? And there were people 100% sure that it was red, and others looked at the same picture and they saw it as blue. How is it that everybody up here sees interest rates one way and then the rest of the world saw it differently? Gene, how do you view low interest rates and where we are right now?
Wow. Dang, that's a tough question. The puzzle with that is that we know that the Fed, of course, it's a Soviet-style planning of the credit markets. Especially fix the short-term price, fix the long-term price. We don't quite know where the market interest rate would be if the markets were allowed to operate. And so that's always the puzzle. I will also say that while in the case of the Great Recession, we knew what was happening. We knew that that disaster was building. But if we look back on the history of the last 70 years, it's difficult to have been able to predict whether a particular downturn was going to lead to a 10% unemployment rate or to a 6% unemployment rate. And so it's difficult, even with the benefit of hindsight, to explain why we had the Great Moderation for a while and why that ended with the housing bubble, why the previous recession that was most severe was in 81, 82. We can sort of invent reasons for it, but in a way we're cheating with the benefit of 74, 75, another severe recession. Then a moderation, now a severe recession in 08. So clearly the storm clouds are building. The most reliable indicator of a pending recession is the yield curve, the inverted yield curve. If the short-term interest rate is higher than the 10-year, through 3-month interest rates versus 10-year, for example, and that's beginning to form. So we see that happening. And so there is cause for worry. But I hate to be completely doom and gloom. I want to emphasize one thing about this movie and the importance of it. When we begin to puzzle over why the popularity of Bernie Sanders, why the popularity of socialism, why the millennials talk in those terms, it may very well be primarily because of what happened in 08-09. Because they saw what was happening to their parents' homes. They came onto the job market in 2010, 2011. They came into the economy when the slowest expansion on record was occurring, from 10% unemployment rates. So they got traumatized by what occurred. And they lost faith in capitalism. And they lost faith in capitalism because movies like The Big Short are being put out, because books like The Big Short, because there is a movie called Inside Job that won an Academy Award. And when the guy who won the Academy Award said in Hollywood, do you know that not a single person has been indicted? Well, the first person to indict would be Bill Clinton. But that was not in his movie. And I think this film was even shown here. And I asked him from the floor, how can you whitewash Barney Frank? That was the only question I can. But the point is
this film did not whitewash Barney.
Well, it did not. But there was a lot out there, and this movie is fighting it. I'll tell you one other thing I wanted to mention, which is unusual, because it's all about something to do with the Trump administration. The Federal Housing Finance Authority, which is in charge of Fannie and Freddie and Federal Housing, they've been putting out research that's incredible that I made use of, showing that the government was primarily involved in what went on through the 90s into 2002, 2003. And then that's when the private sector came in, when they were looking at 10, 12, 13% house prices. And now the head of FHFA is a guy named Mark Calabria, appointed by Trump. Mark Calabria wrote 4 book reviews for me at Barron's. He was at Cato. He's a very sophisticated free market guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, just imagine putting Tom Woods head of FHFA, and you almost have the picture, or Peter Schiff. It's almost that extreme. So I what's happening there is amazing, but they have a free market guy in charge of the regulatory agency, and that Mark Calabria believes that Fannie and Freddie should be shut down.
Yeah.
And they're sitting on top of the data. So there is hope that we can get the word out about what really is causing the problems in American capitalism, the government, not capitalism itself.
That was a part of the problem, is that we rebuilt an entire system instead of fixing the crack foundation. And Peter, again, to the point about how you envision low rates and where we are right now, you look through a different prism than most everybody else.
Well, as the movie explained, I mean, low rates are great if they are the result of the free market. If you have an abundance of savings, you can have low rates, but if you don't, then you need to have higher rates. And, you know, when the government fixes prices, it creates problems. And, you know, the housing bubble was the result of Greenspan lowering interest rates to 1% and keeping them there for a couple of years and then slowly raising them back up to 5.5, wherever they got. And during those years of artificially low rates, we inflated so large a bubble that when it popped, we had the financial crisis and the worst recession since the Great Depression. Now, think about what's in store for us. Because after that bubble popped, instead of learning their lessons, after having blown 2 bubbles, first in the stock market and then in the real estate market, instead of admitting that they lit the fires that they're trying to put out, the Federal Reserve didn't lower interest rates to 1%. They lowered them to 0. And they left them there for 6-7 years. And then they took 3 more years to get back up to 2, and they're already going back down. In July, the Fed is going to start cutting rates again. So if we created such a big bubble with 1% rates for a couple of years that resulted in the 08 financial crisis, what is going to result from this? If we made all those mistakes with 1%, we made even more mistakes with 0. So the misallocations of resources, the malinvestments, everything is so much worse. So the U.S. economy today stands on the precipice of a far greater crisis than the one we experienced in 08. And I think the big difference is there's no more bailouts. They're going to try the same thing again, Liz. They're going to try QE4. They're going to go back down to 0. But they're not going to blow up another asset bubble. They're going to finally crush the dollar. And then we're going to get that inflation that we should have got the first time around, only it's going to be much worse.
Jim Grant, what is the worst thing you see policymakers doing right now that will trigger the next bubble explosion?
I think showing up for work. The longer I'm in this business, which is now a very long time, the more I become persuaded that money is simply not humanity's best subject. And certainly governments don't help, nor fundamentally, perhaps, does the fractional reserve banking system help, although it certainly has been useful in many ways. But before we blame everything on Ben Esperanti, PhD, or his fellow practitioners or non-practitioners elsewhere, I think we ought to at least acknowledge that error is part and parcel of getting up in the morning. What is interesting is the clustering of error in finance. Somebody in this fine movie pointed out that iron ore makers generally don't suffer runs on their businesses. So it's something about finance. Mm. And Liz, I would say that apropos of the efficient markets doctrine and the proposition that markets, if left unmolested, will give us the fine and exact outcome that mathematics would anticipate. In answer to that, I would say that people around money are just as efficient as they are around romance. So anyway, that is by way of citing perhaps a slightly alternative point of emphasis on whodunit. Morgan Stanley went hat in hand along with seven or eight other bad actors to Hank Paulson to get infused with your money in 2008. Not all of them were principally in the housing business. The credit crisis was a crisis of extreme over-leverage and poor judgment that was just infused. And the source of that was, I think, to a degree, central banks, and to a degree, Adam and Eve in the garden.
David Tysite, I really want your answer on this. What do you think is the worst thing that policymakers or even the gamblers out there at the big financial companies or even just regular people, because, you know, some people out there absolutely deserve some of the guilt in all of this because they were the ones who did not read the fine print. But what do you see as really barreling toward the next big crisis?
Well, I think as Peter talked about, it has to do with this next bubble. How are we going to get out of it? And there's confidence in central banks. And when the confidence in central banks ebbs, then that's when we're going to be in trouble. And right now, the central banks don't have many bullets left in the gun because, as Peter mentioned, we're about ready to start cutting rates. And so we have this next economic decline after interest rates are at $13 trillion at negative levels. What the heck are we going to do? And that's when we're going to go to gold, in my opinion, because there is this confidence in central banks that isn't going to be there anymore. There's not going to be any more bullets in the gun. And so look out.
Hey, folks, Tom Woods here. I would not dream of interrupting this awesome panel if I didn't have something really urgent to tell you about being your best self in 2020. I've got a way for you to become super informed, super smart, super intellectually satisfied. And no, it's not the Tom Woods Show. It's the Blinkist app. Blinkist is for anybody who cares about learning but doesn't have a lot of time. Sound familiar? It takes the key insights from over 3,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories, condenses them down into 15-minute blinks, which are text and audio explainers that help you understand more about the core ideas of each book. I like Blinkist because in 60 minutes, 30 minutes drive each way, I can consume 4 books. And I use Blinkist when I'm driving my girls around and I've dropped them off somewhere and I got to go home. I got to have something to do. Listen to Blinkist. A couple of books I recommend you check out that I've consumed myself, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, and Start With Why, How Great Leaders Inspire Everyone to Take Action. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Woods.
Jimmy and Tom, you're working on the current movie, but I almost feel, because this story hasn't played out entirely, I almost feel you have to wait. Because what is ironic is during the election and during the campaign, Donald Trump had said, and we have it on tape and we've aired it a couple of times on Fox Business during my show, 3 p.m. Eastern on the Fox Business Network. he said that President Obama kept rates artificially low for political reasons, and this was just a shame and a crime. And imagine that we are right now seeing the exact same thing, where he is even much more obvious in bullying the Federal Reserve to cut rates and to keep them low. And it's quite obvious in many cases where you see him trying to set up blame if something goes wrong, and say that, oh, the Fed raised rates too quickly and too many times. Now he's just like President Obama in that he's pushing for low rates, although possibly for different reasons.
It's interesting that one of Paul Krugman's most recent columns has Krugman saying that you can actually make a case for preemptively lowering rates right now to try to stave off a coming downturn. But we got to screw Trump. We can't give it to him because we can't let him get away with bullying the Fed. We'd rather have the crisis come than to let Trump get what he wants. But you're certainly right that this is a kind of a continuing story. But in a way, World War II is a continuing story of World War I, but you still need the documentary about World War I. And likewise for this, the concern is that everybody gets the narrative wrong about 08 so that when the next one comes in 2021, whenever, if they use 08 and their false understanding of it as a basis for policy in 2020, 2021, it's just disastrous. I mean, there's still, Bernanke is using his faulty understanding of the Great Depression to justify the wild policies of 08 and 09 and into the future. And likewise, there are Keynesians who use their misunderstanding. So the Great Depression has yielded a completely wrong narrative in the minds of almost anybody with any influence anywhere. So, and that's how many decades ago. So it's so critical to get this particular episode correct in our minds, because we're all still alive, those of us who lived through it, we're all still here, and just cannot allow a false narrative about it to ossify the way it has about the Great Depression, because that has yielded that and the idea that World War II got us out of the Great Depression. Well, that justifies fiscal stimulus from now until forever, because look, it worked in World War II. You just can't smash this stuff hard enough. And as I said, given that we lived through it recently, now's the time to strike at these people.
Jimmy?
Just to add to kind of where we cut off the movie, you know, it does kind of seem like, okay, you're making a movie about the housing bubble, but you don't even get into the bailouts. But I'm not going to say I planned this out years ago, but when we split the movie into two, where we split it was very intentional. And with Austrian School of Economics, they really focused on the run-up being the problem, and that's the cause, not how we respond to the crash. The way we respond is just something that delays the correction and makes it longer and worse. Basically, the other schools of economics, like Keynesians and monetarists, they really believe that it's that response. So this is my ultimate way of saying screw you, Paul Krugman, that like I'm going to make an entire movie about the housing bubble, and it's not even going to get into 2008.
Peter, you wanted to weigh?
Yeah. You know, the bigger problem politically, you know, you're right. I mean, Donald Trump has become everything he criticized to be elected. I mean, most Republicans would never have voted for him in the primary if he told them what he was going to do. But, you know, he got elected because he leveled with the public that we had a phony recovery created by cheap money, that we had a big, fat, ugly stock market bubble, and that we were hiding behind fabricated government statistics that purported to tell us everything was great, like the official unemployment numbers, but they were all a fraud, a con, or a hoax. And then he was going to come in and drain the swamp, and we were going to have a real economy, and we were going to have real economic growth. But then when he gets elected president, he realizes that politically, that's very difficult to do, because now you have to cut government spending, you have to allow interest rates to go up, it means the stock market's going to go down, it means a lot of people are going to be unhappy. So what Trump wanted the minute he was elected was another phony economy, just like the one that Obama enjoyed. So he wants to hide behind the same phony statistics. Now they're real. He wants more cheap money. He wants a bigger bubble. But the real danger now, since Trump has now claimed that he has made America great again by embracing capitalism, by cutting taxes and deregulating, and now we have this great economy, the best in the history of America, yeah. Right? But now this whole thing is going to blow up, and who's going to get blamed? Capitalism once again, right? And now it's not just Barack Obama that's waiting in the rings, it's socialism. We are at the point where America is going to completely reject capitalism based on the sins of government, but not understanding it. And the savior that they're going to see is going to be to go all in on socialism. And so that is the danger, why this next crisis is going to be so much worse. And of course, they're all convinced that what we did in 2008 worked. So if it worked, we're going to do it again. But the fact that we have to go back to zero, the fact that we're going to have to do QE again, is proof that it didn't work the last time. Because what they told us the first time was that this is temporary. Right? This is an emergency measure. Remember what Ben Bernanke first told Congress, we're not monetizing the debt. This is only temporary. We're going to sell the bonds. This is from QE1. And so the fact that they were never able to normalize rates, that they were never able to shrink their balance sheet, proves that the policies failed, yet they are going to do them again. except now we're going to be doing it with a socialist administration that's also going to want to print money to finance a laundry list of government programs. And so we're headed for, you know, something much, much worse.
Black swan. You guys know that term. It's sort of the unseen disaster that's coming. Black swans are hard to see because they're dark and you can't really see them. Peter, what do you think is going to trigger this next, or at least be the straw that breaks the camel's back to this next disaster you foresee?
Well, I mean, what I think is going to happen this time, and everybody just, you know, wants to fight the last war. And so they think, oh, the Fed's going to be able to, get us out of this by printing more money and lowering rates. But I think it's going to backfire on them because I think when the Fed has to start cutting rates, I think rates are going to rise. That's going to be it. Interest rates are going to rise. They're not going to fall. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see a breakout in consumer prices, not asset prices. And we're going to have the same stagflation that surprised the Keynesians in the 1970s, right? They thought it was impossible, but it happened. We're going to have a weak economy, but with rising long-term interest rates and rising consumer prices, and there's nothing they can do about it. And when the markets get a whiff of this, when they realize that, hey, you know, it's not 2% inflation. And in the movie, we talk about how, you know, they said that the Fed said we can't have falling prices. We want stable prices. Well, then we said, no, we don't want stable prices, or we want to make sure we have inflation of less than 2%. That was a ceiling. Then it became a target. Now it's a floor. Right now, we have to have inflation above 2%. But once it's 3%, 4%, 5%, and the market senses this, and they see there's no control, because Volcker let interest rates go up to 20%. And we had a very bad recession as a result of that. Imagine the recession we would have if the Fed stood back and let interest rates go to where they need to go with the amount of debt we have now at the federal level, at the individual level, at the corporate level, at the state level. So we're in this box where if we do the right thing to like Volcker did, then everything implodes. And if we're too afraid to do that, then we have hyperinflation. So that's going to be the trigger. When we get the recession, but we don't get the reaction, when they put the monetary stimulus and it doesn't produce the same reaction, instead it's an overdose on that stimulus. And then it's game over. Then it's checkmate for the Fed, and then we got to pay the piper.
Gene, what do you see as, I know, you guys are all going to leave here tonight thinking, oy vey. But tell me, Gene, what you see, and then David, I'll get your opinion on what is the black swan? I'm always interested in, and by the way, the last trigger is not going to be this trigger.
I do think that we're headed for recession, as I've said. I want to just add to what Peter said, that when we do have a housing bubble, again, but by any measure, it's not as much of a bubble as we had in 04 and 05. We do have a stock market bubble. By any measure, it's not as bad as it was in 2000, 2001. So where we can measure those bubbles, it's a mystery. It's not as bad. A mystery in the sense of where is the collapse? Where is the bubble forming? Where is the malinvestment? In terms of conventional measures, we don't find it nearly so bad in the housing or in the stock market, which are usually the two biggest suspects. We do, as I say, we are moving toward an inverted yield curve. That's bad.
Just stop for a minute? Yeah. I don't assume that everybody in this audience knows what an inverted yield
curve. I just defined it before. It's just measured simply the 3-month Treasury rate.
Which are shorter term.
The short term, that's 3 month, higher than the 10-year, as I've said.
What is inferred from that is that people are pouring money into the shorter term because they cannot see longer term.
Yeah.
And that's a scary prospect. And when you see that inversion where the shorter term treasuries return higher interest rates, that often precedes, not always, but often precedes.
Well, it's almost an always, because as a matter of fact, this is where I want to make the point that you hear economists saying that, well, whenever the stock market, you know, it gets back to the only good quip that Paul Samuelson ever made, which is the stock market has predicted 9 out of the last 5 recessions. that almost every indicator is a false positive. I hate that term. I think just false alarm. Almost every indicator does precede recession, but it's filled with false alarm.
Yeah, Gene,
if I may finish, Peter, you have a lot of chance. Forgive me. If I may finish, the one that is not is the inverted yield curve. The inverted yield curve is actually almost any time it happens, a recession occurs. So that's why I keep mentioning it. But I only want to point out, in terms of what Peter said, is that we not only had the 1% Fed funds rate, we had a very active Fannie and Freddie pretty much acting like a central bank. And while they are mischievous now, they're not as bad as they had been. So I think it's a little bit mixed as to what we're going to be headed for, whether it's going to be as bad as we said. But I want to ask Peter a question. After this debacle, Peter, the socialists come in, we get 20% unemployment. Where's the light at the end of the tunnel? What's going to happen 30 years from now to your grandchildren and mine?
I know it's a long tunnel.
Well, it's a long tunnel, but I mean, you have a crystal ball gets cloudy after that. You only see hell on earth. Is that
it's tough when you're a democracy. You know that's going to be a problem. But I wanted to point out, you know, it's first of all. The stock market bubble is a lot bigger than you think. I mean, there's a lot going on in the stock market. There's a lot of companies that aren't even publicly traded that are part of the bubble now that weren't around then. The real estate bubble, I think, is much bigger. But the biggest bubble of them all is the bond bubble. And that is a huge bubble. And it's not just mortgage debt. It's sovereign debt. It's government debt. So this is by far a bigger bubble than the 08 bubble and the 2000 bubble combined. And we have much more debt than we've ever had, and it's financed to a greater degree with shorter term money. So it's much worse now. So I think you're minimizing the problem by saying it's not as big. It's far bigger. But the only hope that we probably have is if it hits the fan, if we end up in recession before the 2020 election, which is pretty high probability, Trump's not going to get reelected. We're going to have a socialist. And then it's going to go from bad to horrible very quickly when the socialists come in. I've been saying for a long time, you know, when Trump was elected, people were saying, hey, he's the next Reagan. I said, no, he's the next Jimmy Carter. He's the opposite party. You know, Jimmy Carter was a bridge between the Rockefeller Republicans, Nixon, and then Ronald Reagan, which was a big move to the right. And so I think that Trump is the same thing, bridging between two Democrats where they go hard left. But I think the economy is going to be so bad by 2024 if this happens that maybe that'll be our shot to try to get the public to vote for real change, to try to get them to see just how bad government is in all its glory. And maybe we'll have one last chance to bring the country back.
And we're going to open into questions because we have to clear out of here. And is it 15 minutes? And in about 12 minutes. So, David, I want to just quickly ask you, we've got a whole audience here who may be believing what everybody up here is predicting. You're a big investor. Tell me what you're doing if this is truly going to come to pass. And what should people do to protect themselves and their money?
Well, I think you need to be cautious. I believe in put options at this point with the VIX being at relatively low levels.
VIX is the volatility or fear index.
You know, given how much money can be made from asymmetric returns in that area, I believe gold and silver ought to be 15 to 20% of one's portfolio. I think one should be invested in Bitcoin as well, even though it sounds crazy to a lot of us fundamentalist investors. I know Peter's not a fan, but believe that, you know, there's something there and it is a resort against fiat money, and therefore some gold and some Bitcoin make some sense. And so I'd say be hedged, but it's possible we could still be up another, you know, 15% in a blow off top. And, you know, I've been wrong before on that, and I'm not going to dismiss the fact that that could happen again.
Right. You know, sometimes, and they sometimes say this on Wall Street, that being early is just as bad as being late. But, you know, my father, the great surgeon, Dr. Morris Claman, urologist, not a great investor, used to say, Liz, the only difference between salad and garbage is timing. But you can certainly prepare, right? Okay, I want to open it quickly to questions. My only request is that you say your name. If you have to direct it to a certain person here, that's fine, but make it a question and not a statement.
Hello, thank you, Barry Cohn. And I wanted to thank you for the piece on the FDIC, because I think that's really relevant. A lot of what's happened in the banking system has led to larger banks, too big to fail, and all that sort of stuff. And so I'd like to ask the panel a little bit about what they think about the indexing phenomenon. And to me, a little bit of, we may even be seeing the crashing of the facade, which is what's going on with the H2O debacle. that's happening right now, where you're seeing a little bit of a run on some funds. You see that this is something that can be a problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, indexing, I think, is going to be a big problem, and it's, you know, it's self-perpetuating on the way up. You know, people buy the most overpriced assets that dominate the indexes. The indexes go up. Oh, those are great returns. More money goes into the index funds, which is recycled back into the same overpriced stocks. And then the value investors throw up their hands. You know, they don't have, because they can't compete with the momentum in these index funds. And so everything is great on the way up. But when the market implodes, these things are just going to collapse. And, you know, the losses are going to be, you know, incredible on the way down, because there's no real value in these overpriced stocks. The natural buyers are much, much lower.
Jim, you want to also answer that? Or
There's an indexation phenomenon in the bond market as well. And what happens there is that the more indebted or encumbered is the issuer of debt, the bigger position that issuer takes to the index. So stands to reason, it's kind of a reverse selection in a bond index that's not really present in the stock. And if you at least make the point that the bigger capitalized stocks are perhaps stronger companies or more adaptive or more inventive, but there's nothing especially inherently desirable about a more indebted Portugal or Iceland than the previously less indebted one, and yet the more debt, the bigger the index. So there is a very basic bond index in the world is the Bloomberg Barclays Aggregate Index. And many, many investors in the fixed income world tethered to this. And that's one reason that explains the otherwise inexplicable seeming popularity of bonds that yield you less than nothing.
I mean, you've got German government bonds that are negative yields. So, I mean, you're
in
actually...
Germany, you've got Portuguese treasury bills maturing next May that are priced to deliver minus 35 basis points, or 1/3%. So you pay Portugal for the privilege of lending.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
Portugal.
And that, again, that's happening in Germany, and I believe
Germany, you can kind of, yeah, but Switzerland, maybe, but
right.
That's the least, Germany's the least of it. But
any other questions?
This is a much bigger bubble.
I see a hand way up there.
Gregory, standing my dummy stock. I'm a fan of your old people on the dais. And a subscriber to Mr. Grant's interest rate.
Yeah, well done.
Three culprits that I didn't see in the film on the housing crisis. AIG and the subsidiary that owned the banks and broker-dealers that did their credit default swap insurance just was underfunded because of regulatory arbitrage. That, you know, is not because of cheap money or you know, government problems. That was just lack of, you know, smart regulation. Second culprit, you know, was Zillow at Countrywide Credit. And he was making so much money, he just kind of seduced an abdication of risk management on the part of a lot of the banks and broker dealers that just kind of followed him over the cliff. That's depravity of human nature, not necessarily government and cheap money. And then the third culprit, when I was an NYU student, not too far from here, broker dealers could operate only on 10-to-1 leverage. When Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, it was 30-to-1. So somebody at Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers lobbied the government to be able to operate on 30-to-1 leverage.
Okay, so the question is?
Is it cheap money and government malfeasance, or is it just depravity of human nature and lack of good regulation with teeth?
Well,
with the housing bubble.
Yeah, can I jump in?
Of course, go ahead.
Because I honestly, I have an immense amount of respect for Jim Grant, but I heard him say that it's original sin a little bit. So I you know, the banker we love to hate was the SOB and the starch collar who would not give you the mortgage because your character, your credit, your quality was not good. You know, those bankers were the bastards who would not give people mortgages. That's the banker that the left wing used to hate. Now, without any further ado, they suddenly depict all the bankers as banksters, casino capitalists. You mentioned Angelo Mozilla. Angelo Mozilla was not a mortgage broker. He was a trust fund baby of Fannie and Freddie. All he did was issue mortgages and Fannie and Freddie would buy them. So the worst get on top. The casino capitalists get on top when you have a government cheering them on. When you have a government in the 1990s that is causing house prices to go to 10-11%, that is, that when you have George Bush saying that you will give you the down payment, and then when the prices are going up 10-11%, the casino capitalists get on the bandwagon and they can make a fortune. The starch collar guy gets shunted aside. And so please understand that that's the atmosphere that's created. Angelo Mozzillo was given an award at Harvard in 2003. This housing organization of Harvard, basically a bunch of academicians who like jobs in government, they gave him an award. And Angelo Mozzillo literally said at that meeting, do you know that 4 out of 5 of the mortgages we're issuing to poor people are being paid off? Do you know what Angelo Mozzillo told those geniuses at Harvard? We've got a 20% default rate. Do you know what any idiot who knows how to figure out mortgage rates could have told him? Then you have very underpriced mortgages. You cannot possibly cover your 20% default rate. That's not what the Harvard guy said. They cheered him. Those people are not capitalists. Those are the worst that get on top. That's really what you're talking about.
And I'm very mindful of time, and we do have to end this. However, you can accost all of these people on the way out. I just want to thank David Tice and Tom and Jimmy and everybody up here for really doing a public service here and writing the history that is not yet finished, unfortunately. But nobody jump off the curve, you know, when we get out of here. It's a great... Great country. We'll figure it out, hopefully. But thank you all so much. And thanks to the Angelica.
All right, folks, we are at the end of 2019, practically. So those of you out there who are homeschooling and are pulling your hair out, you don't like the direction you're going, you don't like the materials you're using or the program, then this is not a bad time to switch horses. Yes, you should change horses in midstream in this case. And check out the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, but make sure you check it out through my link, because then I'll give you a free Liberty Classroom membership. I'll give you an extra course I created just for your students. I'll give you a signed, personalized copy of one of my books. Bonuses you can get only if you use my link, and my link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. So go check that out, everybody, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.